Welcome to the Ninth Circuit, and thank you for appearing for this this argument that we've set, especially for this case. We are ready to hear Rivera Ramirez versus Garland, case number 20-72941, and we'll go ahead and just remind you, we have set this case for 10 minutes. You know, try and pay attention to your time. It may be in this case in particular that we end up giving you a little bit of extra time, but obviously if the judges are asking questions and the time is showing up as expired, you're free to answer the judges' questions. But otherwise, do try and pay attention and let us know, you know, if you want to reserve time. Even if time goes out, we can give you some time for rebuttal. And with that said, we'll go ahead and hear from Mr. Acosta first, I believe.
Buenos dias, good morning to the court. My name is Mario Acosta Jr. and I represent the petitioner in this case, Mr. Rivera. With the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal. Your honors, I believe in this case, there were several errors that were made by the agency. The first one I'd like to identify would be the error of fact. Obviously, I understand that errors of fact are reviewed for clearly erroneous and under a clearly erroneous standard. The problem here is that the agency essentially concluded
it's not erroneous, it's substantial evidence.
That's correct, not, Your Honor.
Just not the same. Okay, go ahead.
But with respect to the findings of fact, so what I'd like to do is address my understanding of past persecution in terms of this court's precedent. Before we can apply a substantial evidence standard or decide if perhaps the past persecution has to be looked at under a de novo standard, there has to be at least an agreement that the facts are undisputed, that they're settled. The argument that we would present first in this case is that the facts here, as they were concluded by the BIA and by the agency, are wrong. The BIA
Because I didn't see that. I mean, it seemed like there was general agreement about what the facts are. So tell me what facts you think are actually wrong that the IJ or the BIA relied upon.
Well, in this case, the argument would be that the BIA concluded, the court concluded that Mr. Rivera was never physically harmed by the gang members. So their factual conclusion was that the threats that were made against Mr. Rivera were never actually carried out. In other words, there was never any direct harm that was inflicted by the gang member to client.
But hold on. I mean, it's interesting that you phrase that as a factual problem, because in one way it's more of a legal question, but factually that seems to be correct. I mean, factually, can you point us to any evidence that the gang members actually harmed him as opposed to, you know, potentially caused him to be harmed?
Well, I guess the argument here would be that he harmed himself under the threat of death.
So, right? So I think what Judge Nelson is saying is somewhat, it seems to me, and it's somewhat more productive for you to say that the legal question is that they assumed that they essentially rested on a legal ruling that they needed. There wasn't persecution unless the persecutors with their own hands caused the harm, as opposed to coerce him into doing something that was harmful. You can call that a factual question, but it seems to me to be a legal question.
And in that case, then what I'll do is move on to what my argument would be, which is that at this point, it would obviously be something that's unsustainable, because I believe that if you look at prior precedents, such as the ones that we've cited from Singh, as well as Kaur involved in attempted rape. And in that case, the Ninth Circuit ruled that that was sufficient to qualify as past persecution. You could argue that this was some type of a sexual assault or form of rape. Obviously, trying to insert drugs into your rectum is going to cause pain. My issue with the agency's decision was not so much...
The record is that it caused pain, it caused bleeding, so there was an injury. It caused severe emotional distress, as one would think.
Absolutely.
So the notion that he didn't show any injury isn't true. Well, maybe that's a factual determination.
Agreed. But I believe that's where the error from the BIA comes, right? And we can call it legal error when they characterize it as, rather than it being painful, he bled, and they call it what is essentially
well, but they did.
He was able to comply. I'm sorry.
The IJ did seem to recognize that, though. And that's where I'm confused as to how, not confused, but I think it's just an open question about how to review this, because the IJ seemed to recognize, no one's looking at this case saying that there's not problems with what happened here. The question is whether it meets, ultimately, whether the facts meet the legal definition of past persecution. What's your best case for that? Because, I mean, Shwarma walks through some factors that seem to go against your client. Now, you've cited these two. You're right. There's at least the recent case of Singh. But what's the best case that you have? I mean, do we have to say that this is tantamount to attempted rape to get to you in favor of your client here?
Not necessarily attempted rape, but I do believe that it's a form of a sexual assault. I mean, when you're given the option of either being killed or having to comply with their request, notwithstanding the physical pain and, of course, the emotional pain that's going to come with that, any person is going to obviously take the second option.
But wait a minute, Mr. Acosta, I guess I have a fundamental problem with your characterization of what occurred as a sexual assault, because sexual assault has very specific definitions within the all the states that criminalize that conduct within the federal code. It includes specific intent. It includes the requirement that the acts are done with the intent to arouse or gratify, you know, sexual interest of either the victim or the perpetrator, all sorts of things that are just not present here, because this seems clearly to be a case where the gangs were interested in smuggling drugs. It was all about smuggling drugs. And the fact that when your client went to the prison to try to smuggle the drugs, he was subjected to a body cavity search, reinforces that. This is a common way of transporting drugs, not a way of having sexual gratification. So from the start, I think your argument that this was a sexual assault fails. This was an attempt to smuggle drugs.
Well, respectfully, I understand I understand why you would have that perspective, Your Honor, but let me present it a different way. Let me
ask you to back up for a second.
Sure.
I don't see anywhere in the BIA's order or the IJ's oral decision where they said, where they made some kind of legal determination that what occurred here is not cannot be persecution per se, because can't be persecution if you harm yourself or something along those lines. It seemed to me a really straightforward, plain vanilla, everyday weighing of the facts and making a factual determination of whether those facts amounted to past persecution. In your brief to the BIA, did you argue that this was a sexual assault?
Yes, that argument was presented, and obviously it was done so in conjunction with bringing up the fact that when he was first approached by the gang members, it's important to understand that he was the victim of an attempted murder to the extent that they put a gun to his head, right? So the very first time that he meets the gang member,
that's quite a stretch. He was threatened, clearly. That's another thing that's pretty prevalent in our case law, that threats are very common. Sometimes they rise to the level of persecution, sometimes they do not. None of these threats were acted on. Most of them were telephonic. They weren't accompanied by beating him or a family member while they threatened him. I mean, some of the factors we found to take a threat over the level of just being harassment to being persecution.
Understood, Your Honor. And if I may, I believe that you brought up some good points and I'd like an opportunity to respond to them. I believe that in this case, the fact is, and this is a legal error, the BIA believes that the only way that you can establish harm is if the harm is physically directly committed by the persecutor.
But they did not say that. You cannot point me to a line in the BIA's decision that says that. That's your interpretation of what they said. And the other problem I have with your argument is nowhere in your opening brief did you make an argument that there should be de novo review. And you did not file a reply brief when the government laid out the argument very clearly and explicitly that this is reviewed for substantial evidence. So I don't know why we would even reach that issue. It's been clearly waived.
Well, respectfully, I believe that because the government's addressed it, I don't believe that there's any reason why you wouldn't be able to consider it. If the court was to find that the wrong legal standard has been applied.
You don't raise the issue in your opening brief, which where it is required. It wouldn't even be good enough in a reply brief. But meanwhile, you're suggesting it. You don't have to argue it at all, but you can come in an oral argument and raise this point for the first time.
No, what I'm suggesting is that this case is similar to Singh, where the court found that whether you applied de novo or applied substantial evidence, the court had to make a decision reversing the agency, right? So the argument here, Your Honor, would be that the BIA says that there was no harm. So here's the problem. If we agree,
the BIA did not say he wasn't harmed. The BIA said the level of harm didn't rise to the level of persecution, which is an entirely different finding.
Well, like I said, their position seems to suggest that because the gang members didn't physically directly harm him, that that's the reason why whatever harm he suffered wasn't sufficient for persecution.
BIA expressly agreed with the IJ's reasoning, right? And the IJ said, the fact remains that the respondent had actually never physically been harmed by anyone in El Salvador. So there is a finding that he wasn't physically harmed.
Right, but obviously, if you review this, that's clearly an erroneous finding because he was harmed.
It seems to me to be a legal finding that he can't be physically harmed unless they touch him. So
right, and that's the error. So if I make quickly before,
there's no doubt that he was harmed. I mean,
it was harmed.
Severe enough harm is another question, but he was certainly harmed.
Correct, but in any event, I see my time is up. So unless the court has any other questions, I would ask for some time for rebuttal. Otherwise,
no, we'll definitely give you a rebuttal. Any other questions from the panel? If not, we'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal. So
thank you,
Mr. Kinney.
May it please the court. I'm Brett Kinney on behalf of the Attorney General. This court should deny the petition for review because substantial evidence supports the agency's conclusion that the petitioner's experiences in El Salvador did not rise to the level of persecution. As an initial matter,
we have a legal issue about whether that's the right standard, right?
This court has noted that there is some tension in the court's case law, but as Judge Babe noted, the petitioner did not argue in his opening brief that de novo review would apply, and the government addressed the issue because, one, the federal rules require that the parties specify the standard of review, and
because of that, we should apply the wrong standard of review because it wasn't mentioned in the opening brief. Does that make sense?
No, Your Honor, and it's not the wrong standard of review, but the waiver operates that such that if a party does not dispute an issue, then the court proceeds as it would anyway.
How we proceed, that doesn't seem something that makes a lot of sense for a court to do the wrong thing because, you know, as to its role, because of the way it was argued, especially because it's come up, I mean, you did argue it, and we have a set of principles that say that if there's no prejudice and if you had a chance to argue it, then we would reach it. But I don't know if we should reach it, but you can't stand up and say that's clearly substantial evidence. If you want to argue it that way, you can, but there's also the question of whether there are legal rulings here that we would have to review de novo anyway.
You can clearly argue it's substantial evidence. I don't think you have to accept Judge Berzon's characterization. If your argument is it's weighed for substantial evidence, make your argument.
Yes, Your Honor, it is weighed for substantial evidence. As this court stated in Prasad versus INS in 1995, in that case, the court considered whether harm rose to the level of persecution and applied the substantial evidence standard. And that case has never been overruled or abrogated by Supreme Court precedent or by this court en banc. So under the court's prior precedent rule, that remains binding. And that's consistent with INS versus Elias Zacharias, in which the Supreme Court stated that the eligibility determination as to asylum can only be reversed if a reasonable fact finder would have to find that the requisite fear of persecution has been met. And notably in Prasad, this court looked to Elias Zacharias in concluding that substantial evidence is the touchstone in asylum cases.
We're not going to argue about this, and if the issue isn't before us, then we shouldn't discuss it. But if we're going to discuss it, Elias Zacharias was not talking about the question of how much is enough persecution. It was talking about whether there was a nexus.
Correct, Your Honor.
So it's not really pertinent, but go ahead.
Can I ask a question about, so we 2 years ago issued the Shwarma decision. And I guess my question is, how much does that control this case? Because this case does seem to present this extra aspect of potential, like, you know, psychological or emotional trauma that wasn't really addressed there. Do we need to, I mean, can we just rely on Sharma, or do we need to go further and decide whether these facts are different from that case?
No, Your Honor. Sharma is very instructive in this case, particularly in that it went through numerous factors that tend to recur in this court's precedents regarding past persecution. And it
said that there were non-exclusive, that there are others too, right?
Correct, Your Honor. The court did note in Sharma that the first and often a significant consideration is whether the petitioner was subject to significant physical violence, and relatedly, whether he suffered serious injuries that required medical treatment.
Since then, I think we've had three different opinions saying that don't actually have to be serious injuries. Singh, I'm forgetting the Bond, and at least one more. So it appears that, I mean, there were injuries, and there were, as Judge Nelson says, serious psychological injuries. There were specific threats in the Sharma list, right? There were very specific threats here. So that version is here. There were threats repeatedly. There was general societal turmoil. There was asserted injury, or at least threats to family. So which of the Sharma factors aren't here?
Respectfully, the first factor, Your Honor, significant. There was no significant physical violence, and Sharma said serious injuries.
That's a legal question of whether compelling somebody at gunpoint and repeated threats of death to him and to his nephew to do something that was an intrusion on his body and hurt and caused an injury and was emotionally distressing is not physical violence.
It's a factual question, Your Honor, about what happened in El Salvador. And notably, the petitioner specifically argued in his counsel brief to the board on page 24 of the record that the immigration judge was correct in pointing out that he wasn't actually directly physically harmed. So
directly,
the petitioner
is directly. The question is, does directly matter?
Correct, Your Honor, and that the gang members never touched him. They didn't perform any acts of violence against him. So,
but that's not where they ended their analysis, right? I mean, your opposing counsel is arguing that they just didn't consider any of this harm at all because it wasn't direct. That doesn't seem to be, to me, a fair reading. And I appreciate your response to that, because it seems like there's this one factual statement, which seems correct, that there was no direct harm, but that's not what it was all rested on. Am I right on that? Did the BIA error by not considering some of this other harm that was present, just not directly present?
Correct, Your Honor. Both the immigration judge and the board looked at the totality of the circumstances, including the threats. And to Your Honor's previous question about the Sharma being instructive, Sharma also discussed this court's case law about threats alone, which looks to whether there is significant actual suffering. And in that context of threats alone, which is what this case is, this court has required or stated that threats alone constitute persecution only in a very small subset of cases.
I want to ask you about that, because I believe it was my opinion in Villegas Sanchez that laid out some of that standard. But this one does seem to be different. And I'm trying to figure out how much we have to grapple with it, because there was, at the end of the day, a gun pointed at his head. Now, I mean, do we just discount that because, you know, nothing was done? I mean, there was a gun pointed at his head, but he was never actually, I mean, he wasn't even hit. I mean, we get a lot of cases where they're hit by other people, you know, physically touched, and it's not persecution. So what do we do with the gun being pointed at his head? Is that already governed by our case law, or do we have to grapple with that in some way here?
This court has indicated that death threats coupled with confrontation can constitute persecution, but it has never had, there is no per se rule that because a gun or firearm is involved in conduct that it is necessarily persecution. And that would be contrary to the Supreme Court's direction for courts not to impose embellishments on the agency. Persecution isn't defined in the INA, and instead it's considered on a case-by-case basis based on the specific facts. So while threats, including ones that involve the use of a firearm, may be persecution, they are not categorically so, especially in this case where...
Well, if somebody went up to somebody and threatened, this is maybe an inapt hypothetical, but on this direct injury point, if somebody held a gun at somebody and said, here, take these fatal pills, and they took them and they did, that would not be, that has to be persecution, right? Even though there was nobody touched him and it was based.
In that circumstance, perhaps, Your Honor, but notably here, it's a very different circumstance where the threat was contingent and dependent on the petitioner performing acts at least a week away. In Villegas-Sanchez, this court concluded that menacing threats where the persecutor, a gang member, had said, you have 2 days to comply, still wasn't so overwhelming as to constitute persecution.
I thought that when he actually got to the jail and didn't do it, he was threatened again on the site.
He was threatened that he had to attempt again. And then, yes, they said that they issued
and
more
this
threats.
All went on. I mean, in terms of the case law, this was not a one-shot deal. I mean, this went on for a number of weeks with a number of different threats and a number of different requirements of things he had to do to avoid the threats. And then after they supposedly said, okay, then they went and they threatened his partner and essentially threatened him again, or he understood it that way, and that was reasonable. And then somebody else came and asked him to do the same thing again. So this was a pattern, not a one-shot deal of any kind.
Respectfully, Your Honor, my reading of the record is that the threats occurred over approximately a 2, possibly 3 week period, which is similar to Villegas-Sanchez, where the threats occurred over a 3 week period and did not constitute persecution. And contrary to the petitioner's arguments in his brief, the threats to his partner were not directed at him. They weren't part of a pattern of persecution related to him. They were directed.
First of all, a threat to one's, you know, partner can be coercive as to him just for that reason. But second of all, what they supposedly actually said to him was, if you want to continue having relations with him, you better do this, which can certainly be taken to mean because we're going to hurt him. And it was taken that way. That is what he understood.
My reading of the record is that if that threat was directed at Jose to require him to perform actions for the gang, and notably that occurred after the petitioner testified that he had no further contact with the gang members, after he refused to perform any further actions for them, after never being physically touched by them, they said, that's fine, and they stopped contacting him. That does not compel the conclusion that he experienced persecution, which, as this court has stated numerous times, is an extreme concept.
It's not an individual thing. I mean, it's everything together, and our case law is clear on that. Right. It's not simply. So if they had gone and threatened his partner and said, you know, if you don't do X, that your partner is going to be hurt, that would certainly be part of a larger persecution. What they actually did is tell the partner that the partner either saying, and it could be taken both ways, either we're going to hurt you, the partner, or we're going to hurt Rivera's Ramirez, or maybe both. Who knows? But it was certainly not. And they were requiring the partner to do something to avoid that injury. And that's not an injury or a threat to Rivera Ramirez?
Not necessarily, and the record certainly doesn't compel that conclusion, as Your Honor noted. I also just wanted to briefly state that while the petitioner says that he argued to the board that the conduct amounted to sexual assault, he did not, in fact, in his counsel brief. There is nowhere that he made a specific argument that the gang member's conduct amounted to or met the legal definition of sexual assault. So that issue.
Hey, Can I ask a question about that? I mean, it's interesting because it seems like one reason why the sexual assault aspect has come up in this case in particular is because the petitioner happens to be gay. And yet it seems like the vast, I mean, this is, as Judge Beatty noted, this is a very common way of smuggling drugs. So if we did adopt petitioner's argument, would we have to say that this is always a sexual activity, or would it only be a sexual activity, if it were, say, a female, or if it were a homosexual male? I mean, it just seems like odd that we would just cabinet based on who the petitioner was, as opposed to just deciding, is this sexual in nature or is it not? And wouldn't that run across the board?
Yes, Your Honor, there are a number of considerations which could weigh in any number of ways, and is a reason why this court should not address that issue in the first instance, where it was never presented to the board to address and weigh in, which it should be allowed to.
I don't know why it matters whether we call it sexual assault. What matters is that no one seems to be disputing, at least at this juncture, that he was chosen for this task because of his sexual orientation. And that they called him names, and they seemed to say that. So whether you call it if it's an assault and it was based on his sexual orientation, whether it's a sexual assault or not, so I think that's the limitation on Judge Nelson's concern, in that in this unique set of facts, it appears that he was chosen for that reason. Do you disagree with that?
No, Your Honor. And I agree that that seems to relate more to the nexus requirement for a persecution claim, which the agency didn't dispute and didn't rest its decision on nexus. So that is
true. Whether it was a sexual assault or not, it was a coerced assault, meaning a coerced injury to him through through bodily intrusion. Whether you call that sexual or not doesn't seem to matter very much.
I think the point that you're making, Mr. Kinney, is we don't need to reach this. So, I mean, I don't want to get on hypothetical tangents, but it still strikes me as odd that we would say that the same activity, maybe it's not odd, maybe we do this in other cases, I guess. It fits within the nexus requirement. I mean, you could ask a heterosexual male to do the same activity, and presumably it wouldn't be persecution, whereas here it would be because of the nexus to a particularized social group. And again, that isn't really raised in this case, but it's just something that's been in the back of my mind.
Right. Well, and something that might also be helpful is this court has stated in several cases that what's relevant for the persecution inquiry is not the level of harm or the subjective suffering of the petitioner, but the conduct of the persecutor. So in looking at that, the court could focus its inquiry on the persecutor's conduct. And here, the persecutors threatened the petitioner to smuggle drugs into a jail, and he never actually inserted the drugs. He didn't comply with their instructions.
He did try, and he hurt himself doing it. Very much as well.
But not all harm rises to the level of persecution, as this court has stated. And although the petitioner did experience some suffering, this court has stated that that's not the relevant inquiry. And again, persecution is an extreme concept. And here the petitioner was never harmed. The gang members never acted on any of their threats. And that's why this court has said threats very rarely constitute persecution, is because they are sometimes hollow, which is the case here. I see I'm well over my time. If the court has no further questions, then for the foregoing reasons and the reasons stated in the government's brief, we would respectfully request that the petition for review be denied.
Thank you, counsel. We'll give 2 minutes for rebuttal then.
Thank you, Your Honor. Obviously, I would like an opportunity to address the question about the direct or indirect harm from the persecutors, because I realize that that's the inquiry, right? Persecutors' conduct. Let me invite the court to consider the following. Let's assume that Mr. Rivera, that the gang members had subjected him to sex trafficking. Gang members never touched him. The gang members never raped him, but they put him out there to be raped. In that scenario, I don't think that the argument would be plausible that he didn't suffer past persecution because the gang members never actually physically harmed him. In that context,
that doesn't help us. I mean, you can come up with any number of hypotheticals where a person was persecuted and harmed that just are not the facts that we have before us. We're weighing in the whether there's substantial evidence to support the agency's conclusion, where the agency did a pretty straightforward weighing of evidence, and then that's what we do. Just we don't reweigh the evidence. We just determine whether it was supported by substantial evidence. We don't, I mean, making up hypotheticals that are not relevant or not applicable, I don't think it gets us there. I mean, just like calling this an attempted rape or sexual assault, it wasn't. So how does that help us? I mean, well, if he was subjected, he wasn't subjected to sex trafficking. If he were, we'd have a whole different case. That's not the case we have.
I understand. So then I think that probably the easiest way to look at this would be the following. Singh says to consider certain factors, right? And Singh makes it clear. You don't need a broken bone to find past harm. That's why there's case law that has found that threats alone may constitute past persecution. In this case, consider his age. He was 19 years old when this happened. And in Singh, well, the court made it a point to highlight that.
That's kind of complicated. He was 16, 17, or 19, depending on.
Right.
It appears that actually all this happened in 2008, not in 2010.
Right. But the bottom line is that he was a teenager, right? I mean, he was still young, right? So that was something that Singh points out that we should consider. Obviously, the harm here was significant because there was bleeding. There obviously was pain, and he was found credible when he gave his testimony. When he submitted his declaration, he said that he did all of these things under the threat of death, right? He understood it. When the gun was pointed to him, he subjectively believed that it was under the threat of death. If I don't do this, I'm going to be killed. So I think we have to also consider that he did this more than once. He said that when he went home with the object, with the drug, he tried multiple times. He talked to his brother. He told people that he couldn't do it, that it caused him pain. And then he does it again when he gets to the jail. I think that it's significant that if you consider that that was harm or harmful, it happened more than once. It wasn't as though he tried to put it once, didn't work. He said, I'm not going to touch it again. He was in fear for his life, and he tried it multiple times. And I get that he was unsuccessful, and I realized that the gang members then decided not to pursue that any further, but that doesn't mean that he wasn't persecuted. It doesn't mean that he didn't suffer the requisite harm. And I think that when you consider Singh, when you consider the Flores case that was also decided recently, I think that the court should find that the record compels a finding that he did suffer past persecution. And again, I would argue that there is no reason why the court couldn't entertain the request that we made, that perhaps this might be the case that the court invites reconsideration of the standard and to apply a de novo standard. Because at some point, if the agency makes these types of determinations, and you have to give substantial deference to it because it is the trial court, but we know that they're wrong when they make an assumption such that he was not harmed. I mean, the BIA's decision refers to him as not being able to, quote, attempts to comply. The way they characterize it is more like, well, he tried and it didn't work, so it's okay. It wasn't really that harmful. How is that any different than somebody who's punched but not knocked out, right? It's beginning to question how much harm is enough. And I think that's why Singh makes the point, we don't need a broken arm. That's why threats are enough. That's why when you look at everything cumulatively, right? Because I think that's the one word that we haven't said today, cumulatively. That's what the standard is, to find past persecution. So with that, we rest and thank you.
Yes, thank you. Thank you both for your arguments in this case. And the case has now been submitted, and that concludes the arguments for today.
This court for this session stands adjourned.